Hey everyone, welcome back to another week of the Peace and Liberty podcast. In week two, I dedicated a whole week to women and libertarianism, and this week is going to be dedicated to the Middle East and the perpetual wars we've been in for decades. Most libertarians understand the anti-war position and blowback, but few could explain the situation better than the guests I'm going to have on this week. My two good friends, Kyle Anslone and Will Porter, both of whom were experts on the subject, will join me to discuss five different countries in five different days. But today joining me is Kyle Anslone, who, when you listen to him, he's an absolute machine with the facts. He hosts the podcast Foreign Policy Focus and is also part of our Libertarian Union, which is a group of podcasters dedicated to liberty. I hope you guys enjoy this week as much as I will, because it's going to be an educational experience for me. And I can't recommend the book Fool's Errand by Scott Horton enough. So thank you all for the support and kind words from everyone thus far. Upon concluding this week, I will have made it an entire month. So let's keep it going. Hope you all enjoy the show. The Peace and Liberty Podcast, episode 16. All right, Kyle, thanks for coming on the show.
All right, thanks for having me, Stephen.
Yeah, so like I said before, I think libertarians oftentimes are aware of what's going on. They know about being anti-war and blowback, but they don't know the names or the dates. So this week is just going to be a full educational experience, because Kyle and Will, who we're going to have on another day, they're just geniuses in this topic and on these topics, you'll see. But Kyle, I guess start us off.
All right. Well, I mean, the wars have been going on for a long time, and depending on what war you're looking at, it could be a lot longer, but I think you're wanting to focus on like the ones in the Middle East, right?
Correct.
All right. So I mean, the biggest kind of official start, I guess, is typically seen as the first Iraq war. And that would be, 1990, 1991, you have Operation Desert Storm. And, that was Desert Storm, yeah. And you have the first George H.W. Bush going in and stirring up a pot there and, creating some problems. And then, a couple years later, skip a few, the whole time Clinton bombs Iraq, of course, but you end up with 9/11. Then we go into Afghanistan, and you add in Iraq, Libya, Syria, Yemen, Pakistan, and you pretty much stirred the whole Middle East into, a giant pot of problems.
So, I mean, basically what it sounds like, and I just got done reading chapter one of Fool's Errand, is that our politicians essentially perpetuated all this, because, giving for example, we invaded Kuwait in 1990, and Bush Sr. enticed the Shiite Arabs and Kurds to rise up and overthrow the primarily Sunni Arab-backed dictatorship of Saddam Hussein. But after he did that, Bush Sr. essentially refused to back them. He refused to help them. So it just kind of caused a war. And I forget what I wrote down here, how many people died during that. But yeah, maybe you can talk on that and just give some examples.
Well, I think this is the kind of thing that you see happen in the Middle East when the United States gets involved. And for those of you who are libertarians and are, more familiar with the ideas of Austrian economics, I can explain economically, in that you have these groups that are, relatively weak in power, but you give them a stimulus. In this case, it was, mostly empty rhetoric, the United States giving these groups permission to rise up against Saddam. But either way, they overextend and they put themselves in a dangerous position. And when the U.S. withdraws that stimulus, then you still have the Saddam army with a lot of power. And to correct that balance, you end up with, either a ton of Kurds or a ton of Shia killed by Saddam Hussein. So when these groups rose up, they assumed that they were going to have American defense from Saddam air power. And then when America didn't provide that defense, they were slaughtered.
And this led to just tons of travesties. 1990, the groups were then beginning to merge into what we now call Al-Qaeda. They assassinated the radical rabbi Mary Kahane in New York City for support of her Israeli expansion in the West Bank. 92, you had the targeting of U.S. Marines and the botched Yemen hotel bombing. 1993, we had the World Trade Center truck bombing. So the main point chapter one is trying to drive is that it's commonly thought that people are doing this because they hate our freedom. It's not like any of these people have ever read the Constitution. The fact is that, and Osama bin Laden says this over and over, that they're mad because we're over there. And essentially drawing us into the Afghanistan wars, you can listen to, I wrote that down at the end here. It was Omar, Osama bin Laden's son. He said in 2010, quoting him, My father's dream was to bring the Americans to Afghanistan. He would do the same thing he did to the Russians. I was surprised when America took the bait. When Bush was elected, my father was so happy. This is the kind of president he needs. One who will attack and spend money and break the country. I'm sure my father wanted John McCain more than Obama in the 2008 election. McCain has the same mentality of Bush. So very common pattern you see here.
Well, right. And well, this is the thing. And Scott Horton puts it perfectly, author of Fool's Errand, got my copy right here. And, you know, he explains that everybody likes to pretend that on 9/11, the planes came out of the clear blue sky and hit those towers. And then that is what set off the clash of civilizations between the West and the Muslim world, when that's simply not the case. And it's not even that. It was just us attacking them. I mean, they came over here and bombed the World Trade Centers in 1993, right? And so this has been going on the whole time. And, you know, everybody likes to pretend like the Clinton era were peace years, but you have, you know, the 3 to 4 airstrikes today in Iraq during that time. And, of course, that's all capitalized and best summarized by Madeleine Albright's famous quote saying that the price was worth it, referring to the deaths of 500,000 Iraqi children. I mean, that's how severe the U.S. sanctions, U.S. bombing campaign, and how much it devastated Iraq during the Clinton years, that 500,000 children estimated were killed. And, so we could pretend like 9/11 just happened and then the United States immediately had to go do something. But this wasn't the start of the battle here. It's been going on for a long time. And, trace it back more and more and more to the the arming of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in the 1980s, to the United States involvement in the Iran influence and installing the Shah, which eventually led to the Iranian Revolution, and just, you know, little interventions all over the place where we helped either keep dictators in power or try to push them out of power, and all these different little meddlings that were definitely felt and known by the people in those countries.
I mean, obviously Albright was the perfect example, but there's also this idea that it's only Republicans that like war. Well, hell no. I mean, Democrats like war just as much. And, you know, again, the book points out, while thought of as a time of war, during Clinton's presidency, like you mentioned before, the U.S. Air Force bombed Iraq an average of 3 to 4 times a week. And this was another fact that really blew my mind. Not one U.S. plane was ever hit, much less shot down by Iraqi forces during the entire decade after the first Iraq war.
Right. And so it was absolutely one-sided, the whole bombing campaign under Clinton. And I always find that interesting, though, that people say either Republicans love war or that the Democrats are for peace. And the truth is that politicians are for war because war pays very well. You send the money to the arms makers, they send you the bombs, you go drop them on some people in Iraq that can't possibly fight back. I mean, I think at times they were claiming that we are shooting at their planes. And yeah, maybe some guy is standing out in the desert were shooting AK-47s back at them as they came and bombed their villages. But it's nowhere near a fair fight. And I'm sure those guys, you know, did actually think they were going to shoot down the plane. But, you know, what else do you do out of frustration? Likely situation. So, as you said, no American planes were ever hit. It was a completely one-sided fight, but man, did the weapon makers cash in, because all those bombs cost a lot of money. And so the more you use, the more they get to make, and the more money they get to make, and then they can use some of that money, just pay out the politicians to continue the cycle all over again. I mean, you can't find much bigger of a war hawk than Hillary Clinton, of course, other than maybe John Bolton. And, you know, one's a lifelong hardened Democrat and the other's a lifelong hardened Republican.
And not to go off topic too much, I actually just don't know much about John Bolton. I don't watch the mainstream news that much, and maybe that's for the best, but maybe you could just touch on for a minute about John Bolton if you know more about him.
Yeah, so John Bolton is the new national security advisor, and relevant to our story here, he helped lie America into the second Iraq war, by helping to make up some chemical weapons lies. And he was also talking to the Brits about the time they put out the false report on the yellow cake uranium coming from Niger. He advocated back around this same time for the Israelis to bomb the Iranians and start a war. He's advocated you know, through the Iraq War II, that the United States should bomb Iran for their involvement in the Iraq War. Out and out war hawk, a complete opponent to the nuclear deal, the Obama nuclear deal, and a hawk on North Korea as well. So him being the new national security advisor could be a really bad thing. Justin Raimondo, a writer at antiwar.com, who's absolutely brilliant, war analyst, says that it's not as big of a deal for Trump because Trump doesn't listen to his advisors very often. And so I guess, depending on how seriously Trump will take John Bolton, it depends on how serious of a threat this is. But it is unfortunate that, this is a position where this person will talk to Donald Trump and they're not going to be saying good things. John Bolton's going to be saying bad things, to the president, always advocating for more war, because that's what John Bolton does. It's not like even a situation with Steve Bannon where he could say, well, at least he doesn't want to double down in Afghanistan. There's one thing that Steve Bannon is good on, at least. There's not that situation with John Bolton where, at least maybe he's okay with Iran being in Iraq because they're helping to fight ISIS. He wants to bomb everyone, everywhere, all the time.
Yeah, those are definitely excellent points. I guess one last thing I'll mention. In 1996, the UN Oil for Food Program was introduced, and this was a big point. So according to the United Nations, as many as 1 million people died of this deprivation, more than half of them children, in what Americans called peacetime. Because remember, during the Clinton years, Democrats will say this is a time of peace. Well, the 1990s was also an era of endless UN weapons inspections under the term of the ceasefire at the end of the war. And these were done under the pretense of ridding Saddam Hussein's Iraq of chemical weapons the U.S. and its allies had given them, and that he had used against the Iranians with U.S. assistance and against the Iraqi Kurds without the slightest hit of opposition only a decade before. So, yeah, maybe you could talk about that just for a minute, and we're just giving a brief overview before we jump into Afghanistan.
Yeah, I mean, that just continues along how policies of the West influence Afghanistan and change the way that those people have normally lived their lives. Even under Saddam Hussein, who was, a dictator and not somebody I want to defend. But at the same time, much like the situation that you have in Syria, where their alternative is that you have a massive Islamic caliphate existing in the country, as well as hardline, Shia loyal to Iran. That's not necessarily a better situation for anybody involved. And then certainly, if you're going to keep Saddam Hussein in power and then just starve the people, that just makes it even worse, right? And right. That was essentially our policy, is that we are going to starve the people into overthrowing Saddam. And I think the people were like, well, basically what's going to happen is that as Saddam goes, you're going to have an uprising, a civil war, and we really don't want that either. And so, you just end up starving them to death.
Right. Well, I guess we're going to jump into our screen sharing, because Kyle, give me the link for that map again, because you use this interactive map, which explains a lot. I mean, I hopped on there earlier yesterday, and man, it does really explain a lot. You just hover over stuff. So I guess maybe start your screen sharing and just walk us through some stuff.
Right. So this is a screen share for the ISIS ends. This one's isislive.uamap.com. And if you, switch ISIS with Syria or Yemen or whatever, you'll get the map for that country. But I just kind of wanted to go through, and I think this will be an easy way to just overview the conflicts that me and Will are going to get more in depth about through the weeds. When you look at Iraq right now, you can see that most of the country is controlled by the Iraqi government in red. You have a small portion of desert area in northwest Iraq that is still controlled by ISIS. It doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of urgency by anybody to take out these Islamic State troops. I'm guessing that at least part of that reason is that the U.S. coalition is super incentivized to take them out, because once they do, then suddenly you have a situation where the United States loses a reason for being in Iraq. In North Iraq up here is the Kurdistan region, which is controlled by, on the Iraqi side of the border, the Peshmerga. They have some conflict with the Iraqi government. It looks like now that the Iraqi government and the Iraqi Kurds are somewhat at an okay position, although the Iraqi government did just approve Turkey to take out some PKK positions, which are Turkish Kurds that are living in Iraq and northern Iraq here. If you flip across the border to Syria, you can see right on the, I guess, very western edge of the Syrian desert, you have some Islamic State positions still. Again, this is a situation where it doesn't seem that the U.S. coalition is in a hurry to take out those Syrian Kurds, and the U.S. are not Syrian Kurds, excuse me, Islamic State, a little hamlet over there. But at the same time, you have this massive area controlled by the Syrian Kurds. Their militia is the YPG, which is U.S.-backed and supported in most areas of Syria. And they have completely given up the fight against ISIS to go fight Turkey over on their eastern front in northeastern Syria. Right now, the Turks are invading and occupying Syria in order to push the Syrian Kurds west of the Euphrates River. There's a large portion of Syrian rebel fighters in northeast Syria, mostly in the Idlib province. There's also some pockets of Syrian rebel fighters in other areas of Syria, including bordering the Israeli-Syria border. So I think that about covers those two. Do you have anything I should like go back to real quick?
Oh no, this is all really great for like a first, like the first day out of five. You know, like a good overview for people. That's really great. So I mean, we obviously. When did we invade Afghanistan again?
2001. Yeah. We were there by October of that year.
I remember I was in fifth grade at the time and I got in the class, and maybe this was actually in like 2003, but she said we had just, you know, we just went to war. Bush just announced it. It was a really, you know, eerie day that day. I don't know. How old were you during that day?
I was in fourth grade, I believe, on 9/11.
Okay, gotcha. So yeah, we're about the same age. So I guess you want to lead us up into how we got into Afghanistan and kind of how all this comes together.
Well, how we got in Afghanistan, you know, in the wake of 9/11, Congress passed the 2001 AUMF, and that gave the president authority to go after both the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Very explicitly in the bill, it says to go after those who carried out 9/11 and those who protected them. At the time, everybody in the United States Congress, apparently, including Ron Paul, was under the impression that the Taliban, I guess, at least protected the Al-Qaeda. You know, Scott Horton disputes this in his book, pointing out that there were several times that the leadership of the Taliban signaled to the United States that Osama bin Laden was an available target to them, even though they were the controlling force in Afghanistan. So to some extent, did the Taliban protect bin Laden? I guess so, but they also gave America opportunities to go get bin Laden. And if you look back, there were several times where Bill Clinton was presented the opportunity to take out Osama bin Laden through the 1990s. But back to the Afghanistan thing. So that's what it's approved of. Very quickly, by December of 2001, most of the Al-Qaeda guys were either killed or chased into Pakistan. And the Taliban were on, you know, full surrender and retreat. The United States just pursued the war through 2002 and then decided to occupy Afghanistan. And once the U.S. decided they were going to stay and occupy Afghanistan, the Taliban became an insurgency. And that's pretty much where we are today. I mean, you could, you know, go through the waxing and waning over the 17 years of the war and the, you know, different kinds of counterinsurgency strategies the United States has tried. But the fact is that there were 150,000 allied troops there in the peak under the Obama years. And, you know, with those numbers, we could control like most of the city centers. But as soon as we leave, the Taliban have come back in and they now control more territory than they have since 9/11. And so, you know, like I said, there's a lot of details of that war you could get into, but that's kind of a very broad strokes overview of where we are now.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't even know how we get out of this mess because there's so many things going on at once. It's kind of like everybody hates each other right now and not exactly for the same reason. So I mean, what would you suggest we do at this point? Because you know more about the intricacies going on there.
Well, I guess, again, one of the problems with doing an immediate withdrawal is that you create this immediate imbalance because you had all this stimulus power to, you know, everybody in the United States bad. So all the, you know, Afghani government and their soldiers and everything. I mean, we're still providing a lot of the maintenance on their military vehicles. And so their ability to carry out operations against the Taliban would plummet if the United States immediately left, meaning that there's going to be a lot of people overrun and likely a lot of people killed, and a lot of people killed in unjust ways. But then again, if the United States stays and keeps bombing, then we're responsible for that. So, I mean, I don't know. I guess, you know, there's an orderly way to leave where, you know, maybe by the end of the month you leave in this way. You could kind of give some people time to maybe retreat or get somewhere safe before you immediately pull the rug out from under them. But, you know, at least, you know, let all the troops withdraw from, you know, maybe their forward positions and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, you have to leave and you got to leave pretty quickly.
Yeah, I mean, that's been the biggest rebuttal is that, oh, we can't pull out too quickly. That was always the point they made, is that it'd be a spit in the face to the soldiers who died. And it's like, well, isn't it a spit in the face to let more soldiers die, especially considering all the facts we have now? I mean, Scott Horton's book, how many sources does he list in the book? I actually haven't counted, but it's like thousands, right?
It's over 1,000. Either 1,100 or 1,500. I can't remember. And remember, most of these sources are from the Washington Post and from mainstream, you know, Reuters Newswire, straight from the mouth of George W. Bush or other Bush administration officials. It's not like he is citing here, you know, every single citation is Justin Raimondo at antiwar.com, Gareth Reporter at, you know, whatever. You know, these are all mainstream sources. They're all, you know, verified. And so I think that makes it very compelling. And that's one of the things worth remembering, is that a lot of the information is not necessarily incorrectly reported, or incorrectly reported, but it's not that it's not reported whatsoever. They just spin it or have a misleading headline. And so it makes the whole thing, you know, kind of confusing. And I found a lot of times that if I read all the way to the bottom of the article, then suddenly I discovered that what the headline says isn't even remotely related to the most important information in the article at all.
Yeah, that's kind of a joke. I don't know if you watch Tom Woods's and Bob Murphy's Contra Krugman. One of Bob Murphy's biggest jokes is that if you actually read a Paul Krugman article and actually click the links he gives in the article, sometimes he's like linking back to other stuff he wrote just to be like, ha, like, look, this person wrote this. And like, it was something he wrote.
Right. Or other times they will link to articles, and this actually happens, that are counter to what the point they're actually making are. They'll say, you know, the UN proved that Iran is arming the Houthis in Yemen with missiles. And then you click on that article and it just says that Nikki Haley said that this was something that was the case. And those are far different things. A claim by an ambassador to the UN is not a UN official report that something is happening, you know, with founded claims by experts. And so this is the kind of thing that you have to just be careful about when you're reading things, especially in the mainstream media.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're going to cover four more countries this week, but I don't know if you wanted to discuss Afghanistan in particular for a few minutes, if you wanted to pull anything up on the map and just show some different areas, show a few events that happened throughout time.
Well, one of the things I could talk about and that I'm most familiar about currently is where everything stands with the Afghan opium trade and the opium market.
Because that's really important, because I'm also going to link to this. You did an interview with Patrick McFarlane, and he does Liberty Weekly. That interview is fascinating. I've probably listened to it about three times because you're just a machine with the facts in that one. And yeah, I think the opium trade has a lot more to do with this than people think. Obviously, oil is a big factor, but I think, would you say opium is just as much of a factor or not even close?
I don't know how much of a factor it is. I think it's something that definitely is important to financing, at least portions of the war.
Right.
So what happened in Afghanistan during the Obama surge years is they identified that there were some Pashtun strongholds, and the Pashtuns make up the Taliban in this region. And there was a lot of poppy growth in this region. And so when the United States came in and kicked the Taliban out of these areas, they had a huge problem because all the locals farmed poppy. And I think in some sense, they weren't equipped to grow anything else, but they really didn't want to either. And so what the United States did is they provided a bunch of capital investment. They gave those farmers seeds and some equipment. That way they could grow wheat instead of poppy and then produce opium. Now, one of the things that's different from poppy and wheat is that poppy is a very labor-intensive crop, meaning that you had to have a lot of, you know, people out there in the fields actually going through and cutting the poppy bulbs. And so this provided a lot of local jobs. When you went to farming poppy or to farming wheat, you didn't have a need for all these people. So there were tons of people who were now out of work and moved to a different area of Afghanistan. And in an article published in Harper's Magazine, Andrew Coburn says that the population of that area went from about 0 to 250,000 people. And all those people went out there and started growing poppy. When the United States troops left, one of the things that the Afghan farmers were given were these solar-powered water pumps. And prior, they were using these old diesel-powered water pumps that broke down a lot, and they were kind of expensive to use because they ran on diesel. But once you had the solar-powered one, you could pump about as much water as you want with, you know, very low cost. And so all these farmers are able to pump more water and therefore cultivate more land. The U.S. leaves, and everybody goes back to growing poppy because you can make a lot more money in Afghanistan doing that than growing wheat. And so now you have a lot more poppy being grown, not only in the Helmand region along the water basin there, where the United States gave all of, you know, all the equipment to the farmers, but then you also have poppy farmers, or yeah, people growing poppy in other regions of Afghanistan. So you have these massive bumper crops. Now, these bumper crops are often being produced in the Taliban-held areas, and the Taliban tats the poppy and then use that money to fund their offensive and their insurgency against the United States. And so when you look at the situation in Afghanistan right now, and the Taliban grew a record number of poppy and that, you know, turned into a record number of opium, and I'll also mention that the United States destroyed a record number of opium in 2017 as well. So just imagine how much they would have had if the United States didn't destroy a lot of it. But they're just, it's a lot of money. And what they're going to do is they're going to use this to fund their spring offensive that's coming up in the next couple of months, which you know, begins the fighting season in Afghanistan. And you know, it's not going to be a good situation.
That's crazy. I mean, how long has this been going on?
Well, I mean, how, it, like, this particular story, I think, starts, you know, with the Obama surge. I think in about 2012 is when this program started. But I mean, the whole Afghan war has been going on, like we said, October of 2001.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of info to cover this week. So, I mean, we've gone about like 30 minutes here or something like that. So I guess we'll call it, but Kyle, it's been so great having you on, and I guess we're going to have you on two more days this week, and we're going to get Will on this week. But yeah. So which two countries did you mention are your specialties? I think it was it Syria and Libya?
I would say, I don't know about specialty, but since the Yemen war has started, I've really been doing a lot of writing, and I read tons of news articles every day. And you know, one of the reasons I started my show is because I was so upset about what was going on in Yemen. And so Yemen, you know, to me is something that I really pay a lot of attention to, and I really know a lot about. And then Libya and Syria, I've also, you know, I've been following since the start of the war. Like we mentioned at the top of the show, in 2001, I was in elementary school. And so yeah. I grew up believing all the lies. You know what I mean? Like, John Bolton was the expert that everybody said, oh, you should listen to that guy because he knows what he's talking about when he talks about Iraq. And so then, for me, it was, you know, as I came of age and actually started reading all this information, I was like, but this doesn't line up with that. you know, and then I was introduced to Ron Paul, and I was like, oh, well, now everything makes a lot of sense. But, you know, so Libya, Syria, and Yemen are all a little bit easier, I think, for me to cover from start to finish, just because I wasn't fed propaganda about those wars that I wasn't readily able to debunk, you know, myself. And, you know, I've been able to follow it the whole time. And so there's something different, you know, and then experience the story as it unfolds, then learning about it later. And I think me and you both had to learn about at least the early days of the Iraq and Afghanistan war. We had learned about it. We didn't just experience it by watching the news or whatever.
Oh, I mean, I'm going to say a few things. One, just being this whole week is going to be an educational experience for me, because like I said before, libertarians, they often know a few things. They often have a few talking points. My point of this podcast is to break people out of that, because I want people to be able to go out there with the mountain of facts that are available to us and be able to crush their opponents, so to speak. Regarding Ron Paul, I think the reason he captivated so many people is he was one of the first politicians openly saying these things. That man could not be bought. Obviously, like I said, it's going to be a learning experience for me this whole week. So, Kyle, it's been so great having you on. You're awesome. I'm really glad I met you the past few days. So I'm especially excited to have Will on, and maybe one of these days we'll get both of you on at the same time. Maybe that would be pretty productive, but I don't know if people watching can tell. We've done a lot of this on the spot. We just kind of thought this up 2 days ago, and we're just like, man, let's do it. I know these guys have a lot of facts on hand, but Kyle, thanks so much, and we'll see you another one of these days.
All right, thanks so much for having me on.
Hey everyone, please like, follow, donate, subscribe, and share. Any donations will be used to reach more people.